Hi, everybody. My name's Tammy, and I'm an alcoholic. Grateful to God and Alcoholics Anonymous for my life in sobriety today. And is there a big book? Mike, where's Mike? Mike? Buddy, can I borrow that big book from you, and I'll bring it, I'll give it to you after the meeting? And if you believe that, you haven't had much experience with alcoholic women. Can I borrow the book? Can I borrow it?
She really will give it back.
I promise. Thanks, Mike. I'd like to thank Paul for asking me to come out and share with you this morning. I'd like to thank the convention committee for agreeing to it. And I'd like to thank all the speakers and participants, whether you're just a registered attender that came and participated in this thing, or whether you shared your experience, strength, and hope as a main speaker, a 10-minute speaker. You certainly carried the message to me. You know, it's kind of tough when you're sitting up here as a speaker and you look around and like 90% of the room has more time than you. I have 14 years of sobriety, and I'm sitting there thinking, you know, what the heck do I have to tell these people? But, you know, the deal is there's a whole bunch of mentors that saw me come in 14 and a half years ago. A broken girl that had lost her kids, her husband, her house, her dignity, her self-respect. And you guys kicked my rear end into sobriety. You know, I don't know about the compassionate love that some of y'all get. My old timer wouldn't take my phone number for 5 years, and I kept saying, you know, don't you want my number? He goes, kid, when I want what you have, I'll ask you for your number. And it wasn't until I had 5 years of sobriety that he asked me for my number, and I was so excited, and it's because he needed a ride to a doctor's appointment, and he thought I might forget. Marguerite, where's Marguerite? Man, thanks for sticking around all these years. The longer I'm sober, the more grateful I am to those that went before me and washed those cups and cleaned those ashtrays and kept this thing going so that a broken mother without her children could come in and find a place to get well. And, you know, I bumped into Vera today, and I haven't seen Vera, I don't think, in about 10 years. And I used to have these brief intervals of recovery followed always by a worse relapse. And I remember I had about 2 weeks of sobriety, and it was in one of my brief intervals. And I could go a couple of days without drinking and not get too sick, but then about a week after I stopped drinking, I would get really, really sick. And this lady, Vera here, made me some soup one time when I had like a week or two of sobriety, and she called it sick soup, and that I would get well. And I haven't seen Vera in 10 years, and she's here today. And, you know, how do you thank a room full of people for what they've done for you? You know, this old goat Don here that stood up with 40 years of sobriety, you know, traveled down here, and he travels with Patrick and I when we speak, and we travel when he speaks, you know, and he saw me come in, and he spent the whole weekend down here, you know, just to help. Well, first of all, he's here to kick me in the butt the whole way home for everything I do and say wrong, but you know, how do you thank people? And there's so many of my mentors, and it's the little things. I remember Patrick asking Doug, you know, Patrick, Doug, and I all attend one meeting a week together. We don't all have the same home group, but Patrick said to Doug, you know, Doug, when are you going to leave? And I know Doug speaks a lot, and he has a lot of commitments, and I heard him say to Patrick, I'll leave when the last person shakes Tammy's hand. You know, and these are the guys that saw me come in, and they're there for me, and that means a lot to me. Anyway, when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I was living in a 4,000-square-foot home with 3 cars in the garage paid for on a half an acre of land with a full-time maid, and my husband and kids were living in a one-bedroom hotel room. That's how bad my drinking had become for them. I had my first drink when I was 13, and I've come to understand after reading this big book of Alcoholics Anonymous that I had a strange and abnormal reaction to alcohol the very first time I drank it, but I didn't understand that at 13 because I didn't know what an alcoholic was. I puked and I blacked out the very first time I ever picked up a drink. I'm a puking drunk. That's not feminine. I wish I could even tell you that I would vomit, but I puke, I retch, that projectile stuff that shoots across the room. Yeah, all right. Let's hear it for the pukers, right? And I don't ever remember a time that I drank alcohol and I didn't puke. It's not feminine, but that's my story. And my dad was having a business party, And my job as this little 13-year-old girl this night was to carry these little round trays of hors d'oeuvres around. And my dad had a whole lot of business parties, and my sister and I, we were a year apart. She was 13, I think, and I was 14, and I was 13. And for whatever reason this night, our dad felt that we were mature enough to stay and help out at this party, and it was going to be an extra big and an extra fabulous party that he threw. And usually we were shipped out to friends and relatives, and this night he felt that we could stay and help out. And, you know, I never got attention from my father, and I really, really wanted to please him. I mean, it was my full intention that I was going to do the best job possible. And my sister and I had these little matching outfits, and we had got our hair done, and it was so grown up, and I felt like I was in this big adult world, and the decorations and the lights and these little eggs on these trays and little puffy things and called hors d'oeuvres, and I was so excited. And about a half an hour before the party started, this guy came in, and he had a bow tie, a cummerbund, this beautiful tan skin, and a white tooth smile, and he was the hired bartender. And he went over to the bar, and I remember my sister and I jumped up on the bar stools, and we were watching him because he was popping these bottles, and the steam was coming out the top. And then he had these long, tall glasses, and he'd tip them sideways, and he'd pour this champagne into the glasses. And I watched the bubbles go from the bottom up to the top, and oh my God, it was just so romantic and grown up. And my sister asked him, you know, what does that stuff taste like? And he goes, well, he goes, it's kind of bitter, it's kind of sweet, it tickles your nose. So she took a little sip and sputtered and spit it all out. And he goes, can't handle it, huh? Well, I'm the kid sister, and I've always done the one-upsmanship. So I said, let me see what I can do. And I took it, and I downed it as quickly as I could. Well, my sister's jaw dropped, and his jaw dropped, and he said, wow, well, now I got an audience, so I can't stop there, and I guzzled two more. And by the time that party started, I was angrily put into my bedroom by my father, and I was puking my guts out. And I did not know what happened to me, and I had no idea what was going on. And there was a vacant bedroom next door to my bedroom in a long hallway where my dad's guests used to put their coats and their hats and their purses for this party. And I remember being in my bedroom, and I had pulled a trash can next to my bed, and I had like one arm and one leg hanging off the bed because the room was doing this. You know, and I was trying to ground myself, and I'm retching into this thing, and I remember a couple of my dad's friends like kind of knocking on the door and opening up and saying, my God, what's wrong with Tammy? And I remember yelling out, it's not the alcohol, it's those hors d'oeuvres, it's those egg things that I ate from the very first time I ever drank. I was already defending my right to drink. From the very first time I picked up a drink, I was already defending King Alcohol. Why did I do that? I don't know. At age 15, I ran away from that home. To make a real long, complicated story short, and trust me, it was a real long, complicated story. If you were a teenage girl with a budding teenage body and you lived in a home with my dad, you weren't safe. And I'd already been put in two foster homes prior to the age of 15 because of the illicit nature of the relationship my father had with his teenage daughters. And the way it kind of worked is our teachers used to report weird behavior from us at school, and school would call child services, and child services would come out to the house and ask a whole lot of questions. And my dad would have to leave until there was a pending court date. And my dad would leave, and my mom was told he had to stay away from us, and they all agreed, and then mom would run out of money. My mom didn't have an education or a job and was completely dependent on my dad. So dad would start lurking around again secretly, and my mom would secretly bring him back in. Child services would find out, and then we would have to go to foster homes. Well, at age 15, I faced going into another foster home, and this time I couldn't go with my sister because she had run away from home a year earlier when she was 15. So I decided to follow my sister, and at 15, I ran away from home, and I moved in with my now 16-year-old sister, and we shared a studio apartment out in the San Fernando Valley where I lived. And so she's 16 and I'm 15, and we've had really no adult role models and no guidance, so you can imagine that was like the blind leading the blind. And then I became a 15-year-old runaway, and I ran away from living with my sister. And I did what most 15-year-old runaway girls do to survive. I was young, I was fun, I was cute, and I was willing. And sadly to say, there were a whole lot of older men that were willing to take me in and let me pay that price. In fact, the first guy I moved in with when I was 15 when I ran away was 42 years old, and wasn't a pretty scene. Anyway, from 15 to 18, I kind of just lived from one man to the other. And, you know, alcohol was certainly a big part of my life, but usually much more at this point when the relationship was over. You know, when a 42-year-old guy takes you in and you're 15 and the novelty of you wears off in a couple of weeks, these guys had things like jobs and ex-wives. Some of them had wives. they had children. And the novelty of me would wear off and they'd want to kind of get rid of me. So they'd start to exit me out. And that's where I would start to pick up a drink because at least, you know, it relaxed me at that point. I didn't understand alcoholism. I didn't understand the effect that alcohol had on me. Well, I'm one of those Jekyll Hyde drunks, so I'd start to get wild, crazy, dramatic, show up at their job, smash windows on their car. I identified with Ann last night, the car painter. Oh, that's so me, you know. So these guys would eventually get rid of me, but there'd always be some other guy. You know, I was always the girl that I had guy A, but I always kind of kept guy B and guy C in the waiting, so when guy A didn't work out, I'd just move on down the road. So from 15 to 18, I kind of followed this thing. And, you know, I'm a school teacher today. I teach middle school. I'm an English teacher, and I teach sixth grade out in the valley where we work, where we live. And, you know, it is as sadly true back then. It is as sadly true today as it was back then. If you're a semi-decent-looking kid and or you're a good athlete and or you have some academic prowess, school is a pretty safe place for you. But if you don't have one of those three components, school can be a really, really miserable place. And in fact, I teach these little guys today and I watch some of these little kids that don't have one of those three. In fact, some of them have none and they really struggle through school. And it was as true today as it was back then. And even though I was a 15-year-old runaway, before all that had happened, school was a very safe place for me because I was not only a semi-decent-looking little kid, I was an incredible athlete. In fact, I used to play and practice with boys' teams before girls were allowed to play with boys' teams. They didn't let me play in the actual competitive sports, but they let me practice with them, you know? And I was a really good student. So school was always a really, really safe place for me. And then I'd go home and all these atrocities would be going on at home. In fact, I was the kid that always waited for the street lights to come on before I went home from school because I just didn't want to go home. Well, I brought that kind of life into my early adult life because now I'm a 15, 16, 17-year-old runaway, you know, for these next couple of years, living with older men, you know, paying the price that I had to pay for it. And I remember that one day I was in a post office with one of these older guys that I was living with. And, you know, prior to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I certainly didn't live my life by any principles. Principles never guided my life. Whatever was in front of me that felt good guided my life. So if you felt good, off I'd go with you. And if this felt good, off I'd go to that. Well, I remember being in the post office and looking at a sign, and the sign said that you could take a test called the GED exam. And the GED exam is a graduation equivalency diploma where you can take a test and get a diploma that's equivalent to a high school diploma. Well, I'm a 15-year-old dropout from school, and I never completed high school. And this older boyfriend of mine said, you know, Tammy, you were a pretty good little student when you went to school. You should take that GED exam and see if you can pass it. So I'm not guided by any principles, and I'm like, okay, you know. So I filled out the form, and I signed it up because I wanted to please him. And I took that test, and about 6 weeks later, I got notification that I had passed the GED exam. And I had just turned 16 at the time. I actually signed up for it prior to my 16th birthday. And then I got a call a couple days later from the Daily News out where I live in the San Fernando Valley, and they wanted to do an editorial on what a kid that's 16 years old that has dropped out of high school and taken a graduation equivalency exam is going to do with their life. So I said, okay, and this lady comes out to this apartment that I'm living in with this 42-year-old guy. And, you know, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, these old goats were real strict with me once I started to surrender and do the deal your way about how I dress and about my appearance. My language is extremely crippled when I came in here. Every other word was an F word. And I remember these guys would say to me, you know, kid, you don't carry a bad little message, but it's kind of hard to decipher with all the F words and the profanity. You know, and when I was new, I really didn't understand what the heck does that have to do with my sobriety. But I'll tell you what, now that I look back over my story, the woman that came out to interview me that day was only about 25 years old. And I remember she was really pretty. She was pretty. And she had gone to college, and she was like all the things that I had wanted to do. And I'm like 16 years old, and she came out, and she looked me in the eye, and she had on like this little business suit, and she had some recording equipment and this guy with her. But I could tell she was young, and yet she had just done it the right way. She was a do-gooder and I wasn't. And I remember like really wanting to please her. She was so pretty and so nice to me. And women like her didn't talk to girls like me. You know, I was always the trash. And she looked me in the eye and she smiled when she talked. And she actually cared about my answers and what I said. And I remember wanting to please her. And she sat across and she folded her legs and sat like a lady. So I folded my legs and sat like a lady. And she said to me, you know, Tammy, you're 16 years old and you have a high school equivalency diploma. So are you going to go on to like a junior college or a four-year university? And I remember saying to her, what's a junior college? And she explained to me what a junior college is, because I don't come from college-educated kind of folk. And she told me what a junior college is and how you can get in and how inexpensive it was. So I said, yeah, that's what I'm going to do. And a couple days later, it came out in print. And so, you know what? I enrolled in junior college because she was pretty and she was soft and she was feminine and she was a role model to me. And I didn't know that at the time. And so I enroll in junior college and I start going to school. And one more time, I became athletic, academic, popular Tammy. Because I was 16, so I became like the darling of all the professors. And I signed up for the tennis team and I actually played a number three position for my junior college at 16. And I ended up on the dean's list all four semesters I was there for strong academic performance. And when I went to go graduate, I actually had won something called the Chancellor's Award, and that's where a few department heads get together and select a few students from that graduating class. It's just a two-year degree who in some way stood out, you know, for academic, you know, excellence, and they picked me. So here I am, 18 years old now, and I have a two-year college degree. And the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, I hear a lot of people share from the podium that, oh, I have this huge fear of failure. I'm really, really afraid to fail. I don't know. And here it tells us that right when we're about to grab the brass ring of success, we pull it all down over our heads with a series of sprees. So I don't know how you interpret that, but that tells me we're not afraid of failure. I fail real well. Failure's a real comfortable shoe for me. You know, we're afraid of success. At least I know this alcoholic is. Because now I have a two-year college degree, and I haven't really gotten myself in a whole lot of trouble with my drinking because I was playing sports, and I'm studying all the time, and you know me, when I'm in my swearing off periods, I have to make straight A's, eat brown rice and yogurt for breakfast, work out every day, you know, and so I did really well for those 2 years. But because I got that Chancellor's Award, it led to an opportunity for me to finish the next 2 years of my schooling and complete a bachelor's degree at many local state schools. I had my choice of many. And they were going to pay for my tuition, my books, my housing. And guess what I did, guys? I quit. Because I knew they were going to find out all about me. I really wasn't a 3.9 student. They felt sorry for me. I was cute. I was 16. None of that was really of me. And I quit. Because, see, if I went on another 2 years, then I'd have a bachelor's degree. And I guess people with bachelor's degrees then have to go and get these things called jobs. And then if I have to have a job, I have to work. And then maybe like marriage and kids and all that normal stuff. And I was so painfully aware from the time I was a little thing that I can't be a do-gooder. I'm not one of those people. I'm the ultimate screw-up. And so I did what was comfortable for me, and I put on that failure shoe, and I quit. So at 18 now, I've dropped out of school. I'm still living with these crazy boyfriends. And so I spent from 18 till about 21 pretty much working on bad relationships and my drinking. And, of course, when we're not in school and we're not, you know, playing sports and we're not doing the things we're supposed to do and we're hanging out with older men, you know, we get into trouble and we start finding lower companions. And so my life started to skid down again. Well, it was while I was living with one of these older guys, and this was a very violent relationship. I don't know. I think you guys all get a bad rap for hitting women. I like what Ann shared last night. I'll get up right in your face. And I don't know. My old-timers used to say, you know, men unfortunately hit with their hands and women fight with their words. And I'll tell you, I could knock out half the men in this room with my words when I was drinking. And I would get up in his face, and I'd just bait him, and he'd say, stop it, get away from me, and eventually I'd get slapped, and then I'd go running and telling all the neighbors, oh, look what he did to me, he's a beater, you know, and that was my deal. And anyway, it was while I was living with one of these older guys that I could get to slap me, and we were both good drinkers, that I met the man that later went on to be my husband for 21 years, Rick. And Rick lived next door to me and the guy that I was living with, this crazy guy, and there was literally just one wall that separated our apartment from his. And Rick was a doctor, he's an obstetrician, and he used to have Wednesdays off. And we were next door neighbors, and poor old Rick met me in one of my swearing off periods, where one more time now I'm swearing off, and I signed up at the local gym, and I think I'm teaching 5 aerobics classes a day, and I'm running 10Ks and eating brown rice and yogurt for breakfast. And of course, in my swearing off periods, I signed up for school, but I don't sign up for just a few classes. I signed up for 17 units, and I'm just like intense and working out, and I'm crazy, and I'm studying all the time. And so Rick sees me and he's like, wow, you know, I've met this girl down by the pool at my building, and she's academic, athletic, studious Tammy. And he, like, you know, started to, like, really have an affinity toward me. And I think I was taking, like, a microbiology or an anatomy class during that time. So it was a class that he was good at because he was an OBGYN, and he had, you know, taken a lot of the classes that I was taking in medical school. So he used to help me with my class, and we developed this friendship. Well, as usual, it was a brief interval, followed always by a worse relapse, and I started doing the shooters at tequila and the kamikazes and all that stuff that I would do with my boyfriend, and then I'd get in those knockdown, dragout, slapping, screaming, pulling hair fights with my boyfriend, and Rick next door could hear it all between the wall. So Rick used to always be the one that would call the cops, and the cops would knock on the door, and my boyfriend would, you know, open the door, and there'd be the cops, and I'd be in the background going, oh boy, we're in trouble now. And Rick would be standing behind the cops going, you know, is Tammy okay? Is Tammy okay? And the boyfriend would get rid of the cops and get rid of Rick, who I used to call the stare guy, because Rick used to always stare at me. And so I called, nicknamed him the stare guy, and we'd get rid of the cops and we'd get rid of the stare guy. And then my boyfriend would do one of those classic AA pre-sobriety relationships, you know, where you're beating the crap out of each other from like 5 till 10 at night. Then the cops show up and you get rid of the cops, and then you do those all-night passionate makeups, you know, the way we know how to do. Oh, baby, you're my soulmate. Don't ever leave me. So we stayed up all night and did one of those passionate makeups. And I woke up the next morning and I took some liquid makeup. And, you know, the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous also tells us that after a while, a drinking alcoholic can no longer separate the true from the false. That after a while, the only life a drinking alcoholic comes to understand is their drinking life. And that had happened to me, but then again, I didn't understand that or know that because I didn't know what an alcoholic was, and I hadn't read this book. So I thought nothing of waking up the next morning after being beaten up with my boyfriend all night, having the cops come to my house, having to cover black eyes and bruises with liquid makeup the next morning, being up all night doing a passionate makeup with him, throwing a backpack on my back, and going off to school like there is nothing wrong with this picture. Excuse me, get some water.
It's right here. I got you some.
Oh. Cheers. So, anyway, I go off to school and I'm sitting in classes all day, but now I'm not swearing off anymore, and I just want to get home and get that liquid relief. And I can see the cabinet and I can see the bottle, and I know it's there waiting for me. And I drive home and I park in the underground parking in that apartment complex, and I'm walking toward the elevator, and I just know, man, push the button, make it up 3 flights of stairs, the bottle's there, and I could just down it, and just that relief. And you know what? I used to get excited and feel the relief before I even swallowed the alcohol, just knowing it was there. You know what? Normal people don't do that. And I would just the thought of it. So I'm walking toward the elevator, and all of a sudden, Rick, that stare guy, the guy that stares at me, is running behind me to get the elevator. Now, I've been in school all day. I've been up all night. I've been knocked around. I'd made love all night. You know, I got bruises that are now showing because the makeup's coming off. And I'm in the elevator just like closing that door, closed door button. Because can you imagine getting stuck in an elevator with this guy that stares at you? And the next thing I know, his hand wedges between the doors and the doors open up. And I'm stuck in the elevator with Rick the stare guy. And I have no liquid confidence. And so Rick looks at me. And, you know, I used to use a lot of cussing. I think a lot of my cussing, and I used to use a lot of sexually inappropriate humor or sexually inappropriate behavior to kind of put you on the defense or kind of back you off of me a little bit so that you can never get close enough to me to see how really frightened and scared I was. So I remember Rick saying to me, Tammy, can I ask you a question? And I did that runaway tough street kid stuff that I learned because it kind of fended men off a little bit. And I go, yeah, what the F do you want, you know? And he took my chin and he lifted it up and he held it so that I couldn't wiggle away. And he looked right down into my eyes with those beautiful brown eyes of his. And he said, my God, Tammy, what is it about you that makes you feel that you deserve to live like this? And man, I felt that he was just looking down right into my soul. And I just wanted to disintegrate off the planet into thin air. And for whatever reason that day, I got off the elevator and I walked over to Rick's apartment and I sat down and I just talked to him. And I told him the cry of every drinking alcoholic. I told him about where I came from with my dad and why I ran away from home at 15. I told him why I was in and out of school because sometimes I couldn't even afford to keep classes. And I told him one day I'm going to finish college and one day I'm going to get a job and one day I'm not going to have to live with these men that are abusing me and one day I'm going to have my own apartment and one day and one day and one day. day, because the cry of every drinking alcoholic is, I know today isn't good, but one day it's going to all be okay. And I broke down and I cried like a little broken girl. I mean, the sobbing, and he held me, and you know, the red nose and the red face and the gulping, no cussing, no sexual inappropriate humor, just pure pain and fear. And he rocked me until I stopped crying and stroked my head. And I left his apartment feeling about this big. And the next morning I woke up and realized what had happened, and I felt that fear. That fear that they talk about in this big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. That fear that comes in 100 different forms. That fear that guides an alcoholic's actions and an alcoholic's behavior. Because he saw me broken and vulnerable. I had let go of all the bravado. And I did the only thing an alcoholic knows how to do when they feel that fear. And they don't have a higher power that they can pray to and say, God, please, I'm scared. I need some strength. And they don't have friends like Doug or Don that they can come and just talk those dumb fears through with. And I did the control thing, and I concocted and I schemed, and I got myself away to marry Rick 3 weeks later because I had to control him. He saw my vulnerability and my pain. And hence my ex-husband qualified for Al-Anon because he married me. And I'm not going to go on to all the devastating things that happened the next 7 years of that marriage, but I literally moved out from my boyfriend, packed it up, and moved in with a stair guy as his wife. And now I'm a doctor's wife. And I spent the next 7 years punishing Rick for all the things that my dad and those men had done to me. And sadly, because he was pre-Al-Anon, he took the beating. And I was drinking, and I was crazy, and I was cheating, and I was lying. But that marriage produced 2 children. And today I have a daughter, Chelsea, that's 20, and my son, Alex, is 19. And I believe it's through the grace of God. When I became pregnant with my daughter, I became so physically sick. Can you believe my daughter's 20, Vera? my kids were really little when I came in AA. I became so physically sick when I was pregnant with my daughter that I had a condition called hyperemesis, and I couldn't keep any food down. I couldn't keep food down. I couldn't stand the smell of perfume. I couldn't stand the smell of coffee. I couldn't stand the smell of flowers. And I literally vomited for the 9 months of that pregnancy and actually had to go in and out of hospital to get liquids in me because I was so sick. And 6 weeks after I gave birth to my daughter, I noticed I wasn't producing proper breast milk. And so I went back to my OBGYN to find out what was going on, and he said, you know, before I give you a shot to bring down your breast milk again, I better make sure you're not pregnant. And I found out I was pregnant again, this time with a son. And I went another 9 months, and I could not stand the smell of coffee, I couldn't stand the smell of perfume, I couldn't stand the smell of flowers, and I couldn't stand the smell of alcohol. So I literally, when I became pregnant with those 2 kids, went almost 20 months of my life straight through where I could not pick up a drink. And you of Alcoholics Anonymous have never had to convince this alcoholic about the progressiveness of this malady, because I'll tell you, 6 weeks after I gave birth to my son, I woke up one morning and I look at these 2 little human beings, a 6-week-old newborn who couldn't even keep his head straight, a little girl that's, you know, just 1 year old, and they're looking at me for something, and I am so painfully aware that I have absolutely nothing to give. I am a completely dependent human being myself, and I've brought 2 lives into the world, and I'm their mother. And I did the only thing an alcoholic knows to do when they feel that fear. And they don't have a God that they can pray to and ask for strength. And they don't have a friend like Vera that they can come and talk those dumb mommy girl fears through with. And I went and I bought a bottle of vodka. And within 1 month, I became a round-the-clock drinker. And to give you some idea of the way I drank alcohol, I would wake up every morning, go into my bathroom, and I'd lock my bathroom door. And I'd open up a cabinet, and underneath the sink was this huge bottle of vodka, and I'd put it on the sink. Then because I was a puking drunk and I had this really long blonde hair, I would wrap up my hair and I'd put it up in a plastic shower cap, because if you're a puking drunk, yeah, there's a few of you shaking your heads. The barf particles bounce off the toilet water and they get all up into your hair and you have to pick them out after. So I actually put my hair up in this plastic shower cap. And as my drinking became more seasonal, I actually had a plastic one for the winter, and then I had a lighter linen one for the summer. And then I had a sweatshirt of my husband's, and I had cut the neck out of that so I could throw it on and off my clothes, because the chunky barf particles that bounce off the toilet water into your hair also get on your clothes. Then I take a toothbrush with toothpaste, and I'd put the toothpaste with the toothbrush, and I'd lay that down on the counter. Then I would take my hand, and I would plug my nose. I would uncap the bottle, and I'd down as much of it as I could. Then I'd have to recap the bottle because, God forbid, I smelt the fumes, and I'd start puking it up before it took effect. Then I'd take the toothbrush with the toothpaste, and I'd brush my teeth, and I'd brush my tongue because, God forbid, I tasted the alcohol, and it made me puke before it took effect. Then I would do this ritual where I would very slowly release my fingers like this and pray that that stuff would first heat up my chest and give me that light, goofy feeling in my head. And then I'd eventually start the retching, and I'd throw the whole thing up. And every morning, "Mommy, Mommy, are you done throwing up again?" my 2 and 3-year-old would knock on the door. If that isn't insane, I don't know what is. And to give you some idea of the effect that alcohol had on me, I went down pretty quickly to alcohol, and I started to become really violent, where I had this like affinity for broken glass. I would take glass and break it, and, you know, in a blackout, of course. And, you know, thank goodness I never hurt my children. I certainly hurt them emotionally, but never physically. But my husband started to get scared, so my pre-Al-Anon husband decides to hire a full-time housekeeper to come and stay home with me all day so that I don't break or tear up the whole house or hurt myself. And then he finds this full-time daycare to take care of our children. So he would wake up every morning, the housekeeper would get the kids ready, give them to my husband would take them off to daycare, then he'd go and make rounds at the hospital, see office patients all day, deliver babies all night, you know, while mom could just stay home and drink with impunity. Now, I'm not in school, I have a whole lot of money, a whole lot of free time, and absolutely no responsibilities, and that's about the worst situation for a drinking alcoholic. And I remember one day he came home after he had picked up the kids from full-time daycare, and somehow I had gotten myself good and tanked, and I got on the 2-story roof of the house out where we live in Chatsworth, and Rick pulls up in the late afternoon after picking up our 2 children from daycare, and he drives up, and there's Mom, you know, on the roof, you know, wild and drunk, and he pulls into the garage, and he walks out of the garage, and he has Chelsea and Alex. They're 2 and 3 at the time, and all 3 of them are just looking up at me on the roof. And he's like, "Whoa, Tammy, careful, careful, careful." And I'm like, "I can fly." And I literally just jumped off the roof onto his back and his head. And my children start screaming, and I take my nails, and I'm digging them into his head. And he took his hand, and he reached up to grab me to get me off of him, and his fist knocked me really hard on the side of the eye. And I waited till the next morning to sober up, and I walked into the Devonshire Police Division with a huge black eye and a hematoma, and I filed felony battery charges on my husband, because that morning I woke up and I felt that fear, and I didn't have a God to pray to and ask for strength. And I couldn't come and tell one of you girls, "Man, I'm like crazy, and I really do not know what is wrong with me." So it had to be about someone else, and I filed felony battery charges on him. And those cops walked into my husband's office with a waiting room full of women patients that had been going to him for 18 years with an impeccable record at Northridge Hospital before he ever married my drunken butt. And they slapped handcuffs on my husband in front of his staff and in front of all his patients, and they took him off to jail. And that was the only sober parent that my 2 children had. That's what I do when I drink alcohol, folks. That's the effect that alcohol has on Tammy. It was very shortly after my husband spent that night in jail for something he didn't do that he found this horrible group of people called Al-Anon. And I'm an alcoholic that is deeply indebted to Al-Anon, because Al-Anon took away my greatest enabler, and they gave me back a husband, and they gave my kids a father. But God, I hated those Al-Anons while I was drinking. So my husband starts going to these Al-Anon meetings, and I think I call them the, "Oh, are you going to one of your Let's All Feel Sorry for Dr. Rick meetings?" And he would go off to his little meeting. And I remember one day he came home, and he looked me right in the eye. And he said, "Tammy, you can go to a hell in a handbasket if you want to, but you're not going to take Chelsea and Alex and I with you anymore." And I saw something in his eyes. And I knew that those Al-Anons were giving him the strength he needed to stand up against the insanity of my alcoholism. And one more time, I felt that fear that they talk about in this big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And one more time, I did the only thing an alcoholic knows how to do when they feel that fear. I got in my BMW. I went down to the liquor store. I bought a huge bottle of vodka. I plugged my nose. I downed as much of it as I could. I puked it all up in a brown paper bag, threw it out of my window, and got up on the 118 freeway out where I live in Chatsworth. And it had warmed up my chest and given me that light, goofy feeling in my head. And I don't know, this tends to run more with the women, but I was one of those obnoxious phone drunks, you know, where you get into a blackout. Yeah, she knows what I'm talking about. And you're in a blackout, and you just call everybody on the phone, and the next day they all call you, and it's like, my God, are you okay? And anyway, I remember being on that 118 freeway up there in Chatsworth, and I remember seeing a call box and saying, I'm going to make a phone call, you know? And the next thing I know, I plowed my car right into the call box and steam is shooting up. And 30 days later, I'm standing in front of a woman judge. And I didn't mention this earlier, but when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had already been put in 4 lockdown units, but never once were they for the diagnosis of alcoholism. They picked me up as a 15-year-old runaway, and it was always for mental and emotional disorders. I know some guys spoke earlier today where they diagnosed him as a schizophrenic. Well, I was trauma due to childhood, anorexic, bulimic. I had every single diagnosis in those places, but never once did they pick me up for alcoholism. So now I'm standing in front of a woman judge, and she's kind of reading my history, and she said, you know, Tammy, your rich doctor husband is not going to buy you out of this one. This time you're going to do some time. However, I will waive 30 days of jail time if you're willing to go into a lockdown unit. Well, hell, I'd already been in 4 of them, so I said, sure, no problem. And I'm not kidding you, I swear the van said something like 1-800-HELP-MOMMY, and I get in this van and they take me off to this lockdown unit and I'm waving goodbye to my husband and kids one more time. And while I'm in that lockdown unit, I told those doctors what I have been telling them since I was 15 years old. Look, I think I might have a problem with drinking because when I drink, things change for me and I feel better, but I do horrible things. And those doctors told me back what they'd been telling me since I was 15 years old. Tammy, you are served alcohol by people who have no business serving alcohol to you because they don't know the childhood that you come from, and none of this is your fault. Later, when I came through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, you had a new name for the effect that alcohol had on me. You suggested I may be alcoholic. In that lockdown unit, I told those doctors that every morning I would wake up, I knew something had gone wrong, I would go downstairs, I'd see broken glass, broken children, a broken husband, a broken home. I'd go back upstairs and I'd go, oh my God, what the hell have I done? I would turn, pull the blankets over my head and think of ways to kill myself. And the doctors told me that I am clinically depressed as a result of my childhood, and that the reason why I want to kill myself is that I have episodic depression because of what happened to me as a kid, and the best hope they have for me is institutionalization when these episodic depressions come up and medical management through psychotropic drugs, but none of this was my fault. Later, when I came through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, for a buck in a basket, you all had a new name of a mother that every morning would sit and think about ways to kill herself without giving up flying crap out would affect those 2 kids. You called it alcoholism, selfishness, and self-centeredness. The whole world revolved around Tammy's childhood trauma. In that lockdown unit, I told those doctors that I used to steal money out of my husband's wallet, and I'd go down to the local gym when I was in one of my swearing off periods, and I'd buy everybody in the gym, you know, lunch on his dime, playing the big shot, always taking credit. Wow, Tammy's so nice, she buys everybody lunch. And in therapy, they told me that my taking my husband's money was really my way of buying back that self-esteem that I had so poorly lost in that childhood because I had no love and nurturing from my parents, but none of this was my fault. Later, when I came through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, for a buck in a basket, you had a really intense, difficult to understand term for that thing, too. You called it stealing. And not only did I steal my husband's money and take other men out to lunch and play the big shot on his dime, but on several occasions, I took other men to pretty seedy hotels. And in one instance, I took another man on a vacation and lied to my husband while he stayed home and took care of our 2 small children. And in therapy, they told me that I was searching for the love of a father that I never had as a kid through these men that I was taking to hotels, and that my needs really weren't getting met by my husband, Rick. And later, when I came through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, you had a new name for that, too. You called it cheating. By the time I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, my husband and my mom and my stepdad had paid close to $100,000 in expensive psychotherapy to find out that living inside of me was this completely wounded inner child due to all this craziness as a kid. And for a buck in a basket, you all said, no, baby, you're a liar, you're a cheat, You're a thief, and you're an alcoholic suffering from alcoholism. And it's the first time I heard the truth about me in 32 years. And young people in Alcoholics Anonymous, if you don't like the old timers, don't worry about it. You'll never be one, you know? Because these... because these guys really, really do know. And I don't know. I see people coming in. Oh, sweetie, did you go back out again? It's okay. We're just so happy you're back. Come on, honey. Let's get you some coffee. Sit down. You're going to be okay. Man, don't ever, ever let someone tell you it's going to be okay if you're an alcoholic and you're still drinking. It will never be okay if you're an alcoholic and you're still drinking alcohol. And these old goats never patted me on the back. They put their foot in my rear end every opportunity they get. And acute alcoholism absolutely hates the truth. And if someone around here is hurting your feelings, I used to think, you know, these old goats and these old batsmen, they're so miserable with their lives that they just get some kind of jolly thrill out of taking pock shots at us newcomers. But I'll tell you, at 14 and a half years of sobriety, I'm working with women now, and it is so hard to look at someone that you want to like you so badly, and they looked up to you, and they asked you to sponsor them, and you want to do a good job, and they talk all that garbage, and you have to straighten them out and tell them the truth, and then they get a resentment, and they go back, and they tell the newcomer brat pack at your home group, and then you walk in your home group, and they all whisper and talk about you, and you don't even feel like you belong in Alcoholics Anonymous anymore, you know? But I'll tell you... You know what? These old goats had the courage to tell me the truth at the risk of me not liking them and me talking behind their old goat backs. And you know what? I am so grateful that someone cared enough about my life and my personhood and my children's lives to tell me the truth. I am so grateful. They never let up. Those guys never let up. So finally, I got sick of these old goat men, and I said, you know, I'm going to find this really kind of soft, nice, old-timer women, maybe with, you know, the blue hair and the soft skin and all that. And, man, I found this woman, Pat, one day, because I was tired of getting kicked in the butt by this old goat Nick that I was working with. And I went up to her, and I said something to her, and, oh, my God, she cut me off at the legs, and I went running back to the men. You know, I'll tell you. And, my God, take the truth and take the ass-kicking in Alcoholics Anonymous, because I'll tell you something. No one will hurt you more in Alcoholics Anonymous with their words than the alcohol that you're pouring down your throat. No one will hurt you more here than the alcohol you're pouring down the throat if you're an alcoholic. So I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I wear low-cut tops, and I wear high-cut shorts, and I spent most of my time out in the parking lot flirting with you men. And there was this mean old-timer named Cowboy Nick down at where I got sober at the Hole in the Sky. And I didn't like Nick because I would be out in the parking lot flirting with his, you know, Nick. I'd be out in the parking lot flirting with the guys he sponsored, and he'd come up behind, he'd tap him on the shoulder, and he'd say, stay the heck away from this blonde girl, Tammy. She is bad news. And I didn't like Nick because he didn't like me, and I'd be, what's the matter with you, old man? You know, what do you have against me? And he says, kid, you're making a mockery of yourself in Alcoholics Anonymous, and he'd just walk away. So I come in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I took five of those 30-day chips. And I was one of those obnoxious newcomers that kept, like, all five 30-day chips on one belt loop, you know, like, ooh, look at me, bangling in the wind with my five 30-day chips. But I'll never forget my last drink as long as I live, because I stood at a podium like this, and I took my fifth 30-day chip. And I told you all something about God and how wonderful my life was, with a shirt down to my navel and shorts up so high my rear end's hanging out the back. And I attached that fifth 30-day chip with the other four to go out in the parking lot to flirt with you men. But what I failed to mention to you was that my husband kept attending those Al-Anon meetings. And Al-Anon had rightly convinced my husband to get our two small children away from their mother who refuses to get sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And because he was having such a hard time through the courts getting me out of the house, he packed up the kids and moved them into a one-bedroom hotel room. And I hadn't seen my kids or my husband in 67 days. And I went out in the parking lot to flirt with you men, and that mean old-timer Nick came out and he said, kid, you got a phone call. And I went in and I picked up the phone, and it was my husband, Rick. And he said, Tammy, are you sober? And with the arrogance of an alcoholic, I said, yes, Rick, I'm sober. In fact, I've just taken another 30-day chip. And he said, Tammy, if you're sober, our son signed up for T-ball, and today's his first game. And the kids want to know if you're sober, if you'd like to come and watch him play. And I got the directions, and I went out to this little league field. And I park my car, and I start walking up to the field. And all of a sudden, I look up, and there's my little 5-year-old son, Alex. And he's standing behind this big orange cone with a red ball on top of it. And he's got this little bat, and he's swinging and hitting the ball off the cone. and he was so little his helmet kept falling down over his eyes. And my little six-year-old daughter, Chelsea, who I hadn't seen in 67 days, was wearing a little sundress, and she was eating a rainbow snow cone, holding onto the fence, cheering on her brother. And my husband, Rick, who was raising our two small children out of a one-bedroom hotel room because of the effects alcohol had on their mother, was wearing a team uniform. And he was the coach of our kids' game, or assistant coach, and he was there with another man from Al-Anon. And it was the first time I wanted so badly to just say to them, "Oh, I miss you guys, and I don't know what's wrong with me. And I love my kids, and I loved my husband, but I didn't know how to say it, so I did the only thing I knew how to do. And I walked away from my family, and there was a guy with a big cooler in front of him, and he gave me a beer. And I don't know what that guy's night was like, but I came to 3 days later down in Inglewood by the airport, and I had never been in a three-day straight blackout in my life, and to this day, 14 and a half years later, I absolutely do not remember anything that happened in those 3 days. But I'm in this woman's kitchen, and I'm holding an ice pack on the side of my face, and it turns out that she put her trash out in an alley behind her house, and she found me sitting on the ground holding onto a backpack, and it had my ID. And I'm sitting there holding an ice pack in her kitchen while she's giving my husband, Rick, directions to come and pick me up one more time. And Rick drove down to Inglewood, and he exchanged words with this woman, and they put me in the car, and he handed me a manila envelope. And he said, "Tammy," he said, "your mom and I have called every morgue and hospital in the greater Los Angeles area this last 3 days that you've been out. And the kids and I have moved back into our home of Chatsworth. And this is a restraining order that says that you cannot come within 1,700 feet of me, of my business, of our home, or of our two small children or their school, and you need to go." And I didn't say another word the whole way home. I just remember looking at the envelope. And he pulls up to our house in Chatsworth, and he turns off the motor, and he says, "Tammy, you have 5 minutes to pack up some stuff and get out of here." And I remember saying, "Rick, where am I going to go?" And he said, "I don't know. Why don't you call one of your little AA boyfriends?" I couldn't call my mom, my sister, my husband. The only person I could call was one of my little AA boyfriends. And I called some guy that I had met flirting with my low-cut top and my high-cut shorts to come and pick me up. So when he's on his way up, I started taking a brown paper bag, and I just threw some sweats and some T-shirts into this bag. And I remember I had, like, no emotions whatsoever. I was completely spiritually dead. The only thing I remember was like this ringing in my ears that I couldn't get rid of. And I walked downstairs and I said to my husband, "Rick, I knew I had to go. I wanted to go." And I just said, "Can I please just say goodbye to the kids before I leave?" And he said, "Tammy, don't you dare wake them. They have been through hell and back these last 3 days." He said, "But you can look into them while they're asleep." And I walked into my little five-year-old son Alex's room, and he was in his bunk bed. And he looked so little to me that night. And I just walked over, and I touched my hand on his lips while he slept, and he smelled the alcohol. And he opened up his eyes, and he put up his hand, and he goes, "Mama, why are you doing this to us?" And in that instant, I became willing to be willing to do whatever it took. I never wanted to drink alcohol again. And I hit my son's floor that night because my husband came up now and he was pissed that I woke my son up. And I just grabbed my arms, and this is not some esoteric BS AA story from the podium. I grabbed my arms and I said three words that I personally believe every alcoholic needs to say in some form or another for themselves before they surrender to this sucker. Not their mommy, not their daddy, not their husband, not their kids, not their sponsor, not their therapist, for themselves. And I grabbed my arms and I said, "God, please help me." And for me, it was like a megaphone from the heavens. I heard it in my son's room that night. Something from the heavens that I must have heard the 5 months that I came flitting in and out of here flirting with you men. Rarely have we seen a person fail who thoroughly follows our path, and I knew I could do it. I knew that I could have the hope that those people had shared from those podiums in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went down to my home group that night after my little AA boy toy or whatever picked me up. And there was a guy that used to park an old van in the back of the homeless guy for wet drunks who needed a place to stay, And here I am, a surgeon's wife, with a 5-bedroom house, 3 cars in the garage paid for, and a maid, and I'm sleeping in this van behind the Hole in the Sky with barf in my hair, reeking of alcohol. And I don't think I ever felt more at peace than I did that night, because I was finished. I was not going to have to quit drinking one more time. I never, ever wanted to drink alcohol again. And that next morning, that mean old cowboy Nick that used to tell the guys he sponsored, stay the hell away from her, she's bad news, walked in and he opened up the Hole in the Sky. And I walked up to him and he could see I'd been out. I was pretty banged up, my whole side of my face. And I said, Nick, I am willing to do, like Billy said, whatever it takes. I need help. I never want to drink alcohol again. And newcomers, those are the magic words to these old timers. I need a place to stay. I need money. I need my wife back. I need my husband back. They won't have a lot to do with you. Walk up to one of these old goats and say, I never want to drink again. And if you really mean it, they'll go to hell in a handbasket for you. And Nick said, Tammy, why don't you go help mop the floors? And I walked over that day after losing my kids, my husband, my house. I was all beaten up. I was coming off of alcohol. And I walked over and I grabbed that mop. And the day that I grabbed that mop was a day that I crossed from a dying, drunken woman into a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, because like the book says, alcohol beat me into the willingness of only the dying to take these idiotic actions that you people ask us to take. And I mopped those floors. And I was done mopping those floors. I went over to Nick, and he was playing one of those old-timer pinochle games. That's where 4 old-timers play pinochle and take pock shots at all the newcomers. And I walked over with my mop, and I said, Nick, I'm done mopping the floors. And I thought maybe, you know, they'd applaud, or one of them might get up off their old duff and give me a hug. And Nick turned, and he looked, and he said, you missed a spot, you know. And that's the kind of love I got in Alcoholics Anonymous. This enabling compassion crap, it'll kill you. If you're an alcoholic of my type, it will absolutely kill you. 365 days after I grabbed that mop, I was at the Hole in the Sky, and there was a cake with one candle on it. And the room started to sing happy birthday to me. And in that 365 days, that 4 months of sobriety, and girls, we don't promise you your kids back, and men, we don't promise you your kids back either. They told me I wouldn't even come close to seeing my kids for 3 years if I could even stay sober and if it would even be a consideration. And at 4 months of sobriety, through the grace of God, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and some really mean old-timers, I received custody back of my children when I had 4 months of sobriety. And through the grace of God and Al-Anon, my husband Rick decided to come back and give his wife a try at being a mom and being a wife as a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that old goat Nick that used to tell his baby, stay the hell away from her, he went with me the day that I got custody back of my kids. And he opened up the book one more time and showed me that place that just when we're about to grab that brass ring of success, don't pull it down over my head with a series of sprees. And I was really glad he told me that, because I was having a little modicum of success in Alcoholics Anonymous. And if I wasn't careful and these old guys didn't keep an eye on me, I was going to screw it all up. And I learned how to wear dresses and skirts and sandals. And I cleaned up my language. I learned how to sit quietly like a lady in the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the room started to sing happy birthday to me. And I had told you people all year that I believed in a God. But when I looked at my little 6-year-old daughter on the other side of that one candle, I took in a deep breath, and I blew out that candle, and my husband Rick was holding the cake, and I want to let you all know, I knew that there was a God that day. I had finally come to believe. I had gone 365 days without a drink of alcohol, and that mean old-timer Nick walked up and gave me a bouquet of flowers, and he said, I'll see you next year, kid, and he did, and he gave me a cake for the next 11 years until he passed away a couple of years ago with 43 years of sobriety. And for those of you that I was like Nick's little sidekick, man, once I embraced this thing, that old timer took me through the 12 steps, the 12 traditions. He was one of those ones we had to go through AA comes of age and any conference approved literature that's ever been put out by AA. And I never went to a meeting without Nick. And I remember my first year in sobriety, I became like the AA brat, you know, where I was like cleaning, you know, anything that I could do, because you know what? You started to say kind things to me. Someone else shared that. I had been so low for so long that if you told me, wow, Tammy, good job wiping the tables, the next day I'd wipe the tables and mop the floors. You know, if you said, wow, Tammy, the clubhouse looks good, good job, I would just take more commitments. I was so obnoxious. I remember one time this old-timer comrade said, you know, kid, we appreciate all that you do around here, but could you do it a little more quietly? But you know what, man, I was so excited to be on the side of the living. And in my first year of sobriety, I remember, you know, Nick said, you know, kid, you got to get a job and be self-supporting through your own contributions. And I said, well, Nick, I have custody back of my kids, and I'm raising my kids, and that's a full-time job. And besides, I am self-supporting through my own contributions. And he said, no, kid, you're self-supporting through his contributions. So I said, well, what do? He said, get a job. Well, I'm a high school dropout. Other than the 2 years I did at Pierce College, I have no skills, I've never worked, and I don't have much of an education, so the most I could do, I got a job for $5 an hour. So I remember going back to the old goat and saying, you know, Nick, I did what you asked, and I got a job, and I've done it for a couple months now, but in reality, my husband's a surgeon, and he can sign a patient's chart and make $250 in 30 seconds, so our family believes that my time would be better spent not working for $5 an hour and just kind of take care of home and make the meals and stuff good. He goes, oh, you don't like a $5 an hour job? And I said, no, Nick, but I gave it my all and, you know, my deal's done with you. He said, Tammy, if you don't like a job for $5 an hour, go to school. So I go to school. And I sign up for 17 units and I'm running around the campus and I buy all these books and I walk up to the old goat and I said, Nick, I've signed up for school and I got 17 units. Are you happy? And he looks and he says, good kid, now go drop 11 of them. And I'm like, what? And he said, Tammy, you're going to do this a little bit at a time because nothing is going to come in the way of your attendance and participation in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I drop 11 units, and suffice to say, I got a master's degree 6 units at a time, and I just got my master's last year. And today I don't work for $5 an hour. Today I'm a school teacher. I lost the legal right to take care of the children that I gave birth to because a liquid that looked no more innocuous than this water called vodka was so powerful over their mother's mind that it became more powerful than the love a mother had for her own 2 children. A clear liquid was more powerful than the love a mother had over her 2 kids. And through the grace of God, the fellowship, and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I not only got to raise my 2 kids, but I'm a school teacher today. I teach your kids. I teach your grandkids. If that doesn't scare you, it seriously should. You know, I'm going to end up in, you know, all throughout my sobriety, things went really well. You know, I remember people standing up here and sharing about going through divorces or heartache or breakups, and I remember sitting there in my sober arrogance and thinking, God, that's so sad for so-and-so, but that'll never happen to me because my husband and I, we're solid now, and I'm sober, and he's an Al-Anon, and we speak together, and we work with people, and it's all good, and it's solid. I remember people getting up here and sharing about their drug-addicted children or their alcoholic children. And I remember looking at my little Chelsea and Alex, and they're making good grades, and they're athletic, and they're great, and they're beautiful, and I'm the team mom of all their sports, and the PTA mom, and you name it, we did it. And in my sober arrogance, I sat in the rooms and saying, you know, that's so sad that so-and-so is going through that, but that'll never happen to me. And at 11 and a half years of sobriety, my husband came home, and he told me that he was leaving me for another woman. And he said, she's younger than you, she's prettier than you, and she's more fun than you. And I thought I was going to die. And 2 months later, my son fell so hard to an addiction that we had to have him kidnapped in the middle of the night as a minor and taken away to Utah and be locked up for a year to try to save his life and get him my beautiful, beautiful little son that I surrendered to that night when he was 5 years old. And 2 months after that, my old-timer Nick, who took me through the 12 steps and the 12th tradition and was like a dad that I had never had, had a stroke and died. And within a 3-month period, I lost my 3 best guys, my husband to a woman, my kid to drugs, and my old timer to the grave. And I wish I could tell you that because I had such a good foundation in Alcoholics Anonymous, I did what this book told me to do. I drove deeper, I worked with newcomers, I reached out, I participated even more in AA, but I went into bed just like I did when I was drinking. And I turned the heating blanket up to mom, and I rocked back and forth, and I was banging my head and thinking of ways to kill myself. But because I'd been a participating member in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous for 11 and a half years and regularly attended the same meetings, These old goats saw my seat missing, and they didn't waste a whole lot of time in calling me. And one of them was Patrick. And Patrick, you heard speak yesterday, and Patrick and I are a Boy Meets Girl at AA campus. And he called me up, and he said, you know, Tammy, you sound real good from the podiums, but I see that you've stopped speaking, and I don't see you participating in your regular meetings, and I want to know what's going on. And I told Patrick the truth about what was really going on. And in between that, a lot of the girls that I work with, I would call them up and they'd say, you know, Tammy, you're a nice looking girl. You'll find somebody else. And he had no right to do this to you. And, you know, he's an Al-Anon and he never worked on his program. And it was all him. And you know what? One more time, these old timers told me the truth. And Patrick came to me and he said, Tammy, he said, your problem is not your dead old timer. We've all had to bury loved ones in Alcoholics Anonymous. Your problem is not your drug addicted son. We've gone through all of that in Alcoholics Anonymous. And your problem is not that your husband left you for another woman. Many of us have been through divorces and you're not the first and you're not the last. Your problem is alcoholism, selfishness, and self-centeredness. One more time, the world is revolving around your pain. Now get up out of that bed. Put your clothes on, get to the meetings, and do exactly what you were taught to do when you first came into Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's been 2.5 years, and I did have to go through a divorce after 21 years of marriage that I didn't want. And man, I'll tell you, I didn't see that coming. You want to talk about a broken heart? I was devastated. And you know, my old timer used to talk about a fair California divorce. That's where two attorneys come along, and they divide everything into two piles, and then they give her both piles. Well, these old goats said, no, baby, we don't do it that way. You're a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that guy enabled you. He put up with your drinking for 7 years, Tammy, and your insanity, and he responsibly went to Al-Anon and came back and helped you to put your family together, and he allowed you to raise your children, go to all the meetings you wanted to go to, speak wherever you wanted to speak, go back to school. He put you through a bachelor's degree. He put you through a master's degree. Woman, the inventory is yours. And I took my inventory, and I was able to see many things that I had done to fail a 21-year marriage. And we went to one attorney, and she divided everything into two piles. And he took a pile that he was comfortable with, and I took a pile that I was comfortable with. And now he is back getting the help that he needs, because he has had three wives, and all of them were alcoholic. And once they sobered up and got a little bit better, he ran for another drinking alcoholic. And through the grace of God and Al-Anon, he's looking at himself, and I stand behind his side, by his side, the way he did when I fell from grace. And I'm proud of him and his efforts. And we had an amicable, peaceful divorce, and he and I still co-parent those two kids together. And that mean old timer, Nick, he's still 6 feet under. And my boy is now 19. And 3 days before I came to the conference, I had to put him out on the street. And man, I heard you all share about that. And in my sober arrogance, said that would never happen to me. And I'll tell you what, I pay attention to every word you people share now, because it did happen to me. And now I remember all the women that walked before me that had drug-addicted children, and they're my heroes, and I'm picking their brains, and I'm asking for help. And like the big book promised me, because Patrick told me the truth, to quit sucking my thumb. I remember, you know, they had all these fancy names. Well, another fancy name they had for depression was self-pity. And they told me to get out of my self-pity pot and get up and do what I was supposed to do. I went through a divorce. My kid is still drug addicted, and my old timer 6 feet under. And you know what? In 2.5 years, because I treated what was really wrong with me, which was alcoholism, my whole attitude has changed toward it. Same problems, different attitude. 12 steps are good if you're an alcoholic. 24 are not better. And these old goats made sure that I stuck to the program that can really help me, because I'm an alcoholic, and they helped me. And I do want to say that a few of you Al-Anons came out of the woodwork, and my God, you are courageous people. And you helped me a lot, and life is good. I can never give back to Alcoholics Anonymous, which you've given me, but I'm going to sure go down trying. And again, I want to thank all the old-timers that told me the truth and continue to tell me the truth. And I'm sure I'll get an earful from Don. Don has 40 years of sobriety, and after Nick passed away, I was really lost and floundering, and he stepped up to the plate, and he's really involved in my sobriety, and I'm really grateful for that. And I hope that one day I can pass down. I mean, I do everything I can now to pass the message that is given to me, but I can never give away what you people have given me, because if I could, I'd sure as heck give it all to my 19-year-old son right now, and I can't, but I can sure pass on the message. I thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous, and I thank each and every one of you in Alcoholics Anonymous for God. Thanks for having me.
We hope you've enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the Month Club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.